The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and a very warm World War II welcome to the, indeed, Fighting Through podcast. Just in case you're confused by the introductory music, it's certainly music that I would have chosen had I not been able to have the music I've got for the Fighting Through podcast. I'm Paul Cheel, and this episode 52, I'm bringing you a special guest production of another podcast. Not one of mine. For you, Tommy, Zivar is offer is an oft-heard phrase in wartime, and it should be no surprise that today's featured podcast, called For You, The War Is Over, is about prisoners of war, their trials and tribulations of capture and escape. It's produced by two guys called Dave and Dave. So this is a bonus episode where I'm playing you the first full episode from the show about the wooden horse escape. And this is Dave and Dave's background blurb on their podcast. For you, The War Is Over is a familiar refrain to anyone who's watched the classic films of Second World War prisoner of war escape films. The Great Escape, The Colditz Story, The Wooden Horse and many more. It signified capture, imprisonment, and an expected acceptance that a prisoner's time as an active belligerent was over. However, for a small minority of prisoners of war, the opposite was true. It acted as a taunt and a spur to them to carry on their own private war on the enemy by opening up a front in the prison camp. For some, they were driven by making themselves as much of a nuisance to their capture as possible through escape. For others, it was a sport, while many just couldn't bear captivity and wanted to go home. Regardless of their motives, these prisoners of war formed an elite group of escapers, of which there were thousands of attempts throughout the war and hundreds of successes. In For You, The War Is Over, we look at the stories of these escapes and the people who enacted them. First and foremost, they are true adventure stories, but they're also stories of human courage and endeavour. In each episode, we look at a new POW escapee and the story behind how they were captured, what their lives were like in the POW camps, and how they escaped. We also look at the lengths they went to in order to prepare for their escape and the challenges they faced and overcame in pursuit of their freedom. However, we also try to look at who they were, what drove them, how their escape efforts reflected their personality, and what the individual's character brought to their own unique escape style. These were remarkable people who did remarkable things in extremely challenging conditions. We hope you enjoy hearing about them as much as we enjoyed speaking about them. This first episode looks at the story of Lieutenant Richard Codner and Flight Lieutenant Eric Williams and their escape from Stalag Luft 3. And listener, highly recommended by me, Paul Cheel, is a very poignant episode 6 with Tony Hoskins on the life and escape of Sandy Gunn. So take a shifty at that one too. So without further ado, I'll crack on and proudly introduce For You, The War Is Over.
Well, welcome to episode one of the podcast For You, The War Is Over, hosted by me, Dave, the history nerd.
And by me, Dave, the tech geek.
You can find us on Twitter at FITWIO.
I'm so glad you said that. I still can't do it.
Which, of course, are the initials for You, The War Is Over. Episode one, we will be covering one of the, what I think is one of the most interesting and certainly one of the more famous escapes of the Second World War. We are, of course, looking at Second World War, prisoner of war escapes in this podcast. So, yeah, we're going to kick off with the Wooden Horse escape. Dave?
It's a good escape.
It is a good escape. It's a fantastic escape. So, my interest in this stems from my childhood. I've been fascinated by Second World War escapes for as long as I can remember. I used to read the books when I was a little boy. My dad gave me the books, in fact. So this is one that I have been familiar with since I was about the age of 8. So it's a long-standing adventure story in my life, shall we say. So the Wooden Horse, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, took place in 1943. It was the escape of three prisoners of war from Stalag-Luft 3, the same prisoner of war camp as the Great Escape, which was to happen the following year in March 24th, 1944.
So this prison's not got a very good record then.
Well, it did and it didn't. Two of the most famous escapes took place from it, but I think I'm right in saying that they were the only two escapes that were successful from it. So it did and it didn't have a good record. It just seemed to attract high-profile escapes. So three people escaped in the Wooden Horse, Eric Williams, Richard Codner, and Oliver Philpott. We're going to cover Codner and Williams in today's podcast because they escaped together. Philpott, although he escaped through the Wooden Horse with them, they went their separate ways not long after they got out of the tunnel. We will be looking at Oliver Philpott's escape in the next episode, but we're going to look at Codner and Williams today. So, Williams and Codner, who were they? Yeah, we should probably do a little bit on...
Yeah, I mean, it'll be good to know the story, the background or who our heroes are in this story.
Well, quite right. I mean, the reports that we are working from, which is the original escape reports, they're not biographical. It's a report of their escape experience.
It's incredible to have them, though, I have to say. The actual... just the copies of the reports as they exist from the time.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, they're a fascinating read and what have you, but as I say, they're not biographical, so there is some biographical detail, but there's not a great deal that tells you too much about them. But Eric Williams was Flight Lieutenant Eric Williams. He was in Bomber Command, 7th Squadron, flying out of Bassingbourne. Actually, he was a bomb aimer.
Wow.
He was actually an architect during peacetime. And he lived in northwest London, actually not far from what is now the RAF Museum, which when I was looking up some of the background details for this podcast, I actually thought was fantastic.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's certainly within walking distance. So yeah, the RAF Museum, I think it's at Hendon, I think it's that one. And that's Eric Williams. Richard Codner, there's even less known about him, if you like. He was only 20 when he signed up.
Oh, that's young.
I know. Signed up for the army. He was in the Royal Artillery. And he was actually a student when he signed up. So he'd already done a year or two at university. I'm not actually 100% sure which university he was at. But in the book of the Wooden Horse, he is actually referred repeatedly to as the child.
The child.
He was 23 by the time of the escape.
Right.
But he was 20 at the time he signed up.
God, could you imagine being through all of that and having been for an escape by the time you're 23?
I know. I didn't graduate till I was 23.
That's madness.
I know. So Codner, who fought in the Royal Artillery, was captured at Medez El Bad, I hope I pronounced that correctly, which was during the North Africa campaign, about 60 kilometres from Tunis, capital of Tunisia. He was captured there, taken over to Italy, and then transported up to Stalag-Luft 3. Flight Lieutenant Williams was in a short Stirling bomber, shot down on a bombing raid over Germany on the 17th / 18th the night of the 17th, 18th December 1942, and he actually evaded capture for a couple of days. So he wasn't picked up immediately, but was eventually caught and was sent to O-Flag 21B at Schuben in Poland, where he actually met Codner. They were together in that camp, and that was where they made their first escape attempt together.
Oh.
Eventually, they were sent to Stalów 3 in Zagan, which is now in Poland.
So they were caught in their first escape attempts.
They were caught in their first escape attempts, exactly. But it did mean that they had previous escape attempt experience.
And they were tenacious.
Tenacious, exactly. There did seem to be a certain type of person who would try escape. It was actually a minority. It was a very small percentage of the prisoner of war camp population who would attempt it. Estimates range between 5 to 15%.
Wow, that's not many people.
It's really not at all. Vast majority were only too happy to not be shot at anymore.
I guess, yeah, given the choice of being shot at every day or being in a place where at least you get security, presumably being a prison.
Yeah.
And food, then...
Yeah,
some people have made that choice.
You know, a prisoner of war camp wasn't exactly a luxury holiday.
No,
but,
true.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't on the front line. You weren't being shot at. You weren't being shot down. You weren't being bombed. It was relatively safe. It was relatively warm, and it was relatively well fed, in the sense of there was a minimum number of calories that they needed to receive every single day by legal requirement, and they largely did.
Okay.
These were supplemented by the Red Cross parcels, right. So they were regularly receiving top-ups on that. So they were, as I say, it wasn't Butland. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a holiday camp.
I love that your choice to go to is Butlands.
Yeah, which I've never stayed in my life. But, you know, it wasn't a holiday camp, but it was relatively safe, warm, and secure. And so the vast majority actually took the opportunity to not be shot at for the rest of the war. Even educational opportunities. You could study for your degree. Number of people did. In fact, Tolkien marked prisoner of war camp exams.
Really?
Yes. Little side note. fascinating little side note. He was known to mark prisoner of war camp exams.
I wonder whether he drew any inspiration from any of the exams written by the prisoners.
The Mines of Moria, drawn from, you know, various tunneling efforts.
Yeah.
It was a relatively small percentage of the prison population who would attempt escapes. And so, yeah, there's... it was a certain type of personality, and tenacious is certainly one of them. But we can go into that in greater depth in another episode. It was Williams who actually came up with the wooden horse concept for escape. So maybe to give some background detail, Stalów 3, as anyone who has seen the film of The Great Escape will know, was on a sandy plain. Trees were removed, so it was surrounded by a tree line, but it was on a sandy plain, with a whole series of huts right in the middle of any compound. It was made up of four compounds, I believe, and all the huts were located in the middle of the compound, meaning that any tunnels that were dug from a hut had to be around about 300 feet long, which is...
It's a long tunnel.
It's a long tunnel. It's also, by extension, means that it's going to have high engineering and high construction levels.
Yeah, because something like that would collapse easily, surely.
Yep. In order to get around that, in the wooden horse, they decided that they would start digging the tunnel in the middle of the exercise compound. So every compound had a space for exercise, so whether that was playing rugby, football, hockey, whatever, or just walking around the compound. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that they even established a golf course in at least one of them. It might even have been this one. There was an exercise compound, what they called the circuit, and people would walk around it or use it for various forms of exercise. And Eric Williams, who was of course familiar with the Greek tragedies and various Greek stories from a classical education, hit upon the idea of the Trojan horse, which of course is very famous, in which, you actually would probably know this one better than I do. Do you want to give some detail on the Trojan horse?
Well, you see, now you've put me on the spot to see whether I can remember any of these details, but it was It was during the sack of Troy, wasn't it? It was
the armies of Greece.
I believe so.
I'm going to have to double check this, and if the details are wrong, I'll either look really embarrassed, or you'll hear an edited version of me coming from the future to change this now. But I believe it was that they were trying to break in and sack Troy as a city, but were having not much success. So they built a giant wooden horse as a gift for them, and
which is lovely.
You know, giant. I don't know why anyone
wouldn't accept a giant wooden horse as a gift.
I've got the perfect place to put that. It's in like my a living pinata. Room. You know. So they left it outside the gates as a gift for Troy, and Troy thought, wow, what a lovely gift, and eventually brought it inside. But what they didn't know was that it was full of soldiers that basically waited until nighttime, jumped out of the horse, and then used the fact that they were already inside the walls of the city to sack the city and successfully take over in that situation. So it worked, yeah.
So Eric Williams was inspired by this story to build a wooden vaulting horse, the sort of vaulting horse you might find in any standard gymnasium.
I was going to say, just to be clear, he didn't build like a small wooden rocking horse.
It was a gymnasium-style vaulting horse, the sort of thing that you still see to this day in the Olympics.
Yep.
So he managed to sign up a whole bunch of prisoners of war to take part as vaulters, because of course the point was that it had to appear to be a legitimate source of exercise. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Germans were only too happy to sign off on this, because if they were spending their time vaulting horses in the middle of the compound, they probably weren't spending their time trying to escape. Little did they know.
I was going
to
say, yeah.
And so for the first week of the escape attempt, they would just send prisoners out to go and vault the horse.
So they didn't start straight away with the plan?
Didn't start straight away. In fact, they intentionally overturned the horse on the first day so that it could very clearly see underneath the horse itself. And
it's very clever.
So that the guards in the watchtower and patrolling the exterior of the camp could see underneath. Mm-hmm. And they, of course, put the horse in the same location every single day. This partly so that they secured their own space for vaulting, so it wasn't in the way of anyone taking part in the...
So the horse didn't live in one area, they moved it?
No. It would be kept overnight in, I think, a space in the theatre.
Right, okay.
Or in the barbershop or something like that. And then we'd be taken out for an hour's exercise every single day, sometimes twice a day.
Okay.
But we'd be taken out every single day for people to exercise over. After a week of doing this, they started sending out Codner and Williams underneath. So they would carry them out. So when they were carrying out the vaulting horse, they would be inside the vaulting horse, and they would take them out and put them on the same location, and they started digging the tunnel from the same location in the middle of the compound.
Wow.
Thus shortening the length that you had to tunnel from about 300 feet to around about 100 feet, making it not easy, but easier.
I was going to say, still a long tunnel, but not as difficult as it could have been.
Exactly, and in some ways, you know, what's so clever about it is they were hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
You know, they were literally... If the vaulting horse had overturned again, they would have found a great big hole in the middle of the compound where there were two people down there digging away.
Yeah, so they had to be very careful, I assume, after that.
Had to be very careful, and they had to be pretty good as well.
So the people that were vaulting then, they were in on the plan?
Some were. Not all of them were. Some just thought it was a great wheeze. Just a good way of exercise to keep fit while stuck in camp and captivity and what have you. And then others, certainly members of the escape committee, were in on the exercise and were certainly taking part as vaulters as well. So not all were in on it, but some were. It was seen as a legitimate sport, but also used for nefarious means.
Yeah.
because it was a relatively short tunnel, they actually managed to complete it in a relative short period of time. Just a, I think it was around 6 weeks.
Wow, that's yeah, that's not a lot of time considering.
Not really. I mean, you could only dig so far. I mean, the tunnels weren't. I mean, they were about a. They were only as wide as a person, basically. Mm. You know, it wasn't. Again, if you've seen The Great Escape, they look about 5 feet wide. Yeah. That was as much so that they could fit cameras
in. I was going to say, that's for a crew and everything.
Exactly. So it's not a very accurate representation of how big a tunnel actually was. And you obviously wanted to minimize how big it was to avoid them collapsing, but also the amount that you had to dig out. Because one of the biggest challenges of digging the tunnel was dispersal of sand.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
So if you just dumped a whole load of sand in the middle of the compound, the Germans might have got a touch suspicious.
Someone might notice a pile of sand where there was not a pile of sand previously.
Exactly. And also because the top soil layer was yellow because it was dried out by the sun. But underneath that, it was a sort of greyish colour.
So it was noticeably different.
It was noticeably different. It was grey versus yellow. And so dispersal of that was very difficult. Mm. And there were various efforts to that, but by and large, on this escape, they essentially stuck it in the attic above the theatre. as good a place as any. Because they stored the vaulting horse in an annex of the theatre, they essentially just kind of hid the sand directly above it. They just cut a hole.
So what did they do? They pulled the sand out from the tunnel, put it into the vaulting horse, and then they moved it back away.
So the horse itself had hooks inside, drilled into the top of the horse.
On the inside,
oh, exactly. Right, okay, yeah. And from there, you could hang bags, and they would just fill the bags with sand. Right. And then as they were carrying the two tunnelers back, or actually, sometimes one tunneler, and ultimately in the final escape, there was as many as three. So it must have weighed a ton.
You've got to have some strong people carrying it back and forth to make it.
Especially after an hour's worth of vaulting.
Yeah, to make it like appear the same weight going out as it is coming in.
Exactly, yeah.
Because obviously, I'm presuming it would be a lot heavier going back out of back out into the theatre than it was coming out onto the forecourt.
Precisely, it was much heavier. And so when they got it back into the theatre building, they would overturn it, take out the bags, and just hand them directly up into the attic, and they would disperse the sand there. But, I mean, by the end of it, there must have been tons of sand up there.
Could you imagine if the ceiling came down with the weight of the sand?
It wasn't unknown in other efforts, because it's not like this was the only, you know, tunnel that ever happened.
Yeah.
And there were hundreds of tunnels that were tried, and sand dispersal was always an issue. Some people tried to send it down the toilet and various other efforts like that, and of course, famously, in The Great Escape, they would walk around in groups and tread it into the ground so that it got mixed in, and dug gardens, that sort of thing, to mix it into the garden. There was all sorts of ways that they did it, but in this one, they largely stuffed it into the attic of the theatre.
As you were describing that, I'm not sure how accurate this is at all, because I'm going to admit it's pulled straight from a movie, but I just had a picture of Andy Dufresne dropping the dirt down from his wall down the inside of his trouser leg and just sort of stepping it into the court and then leaving.
Basically the same thing, yeah.
Right.
Although you're correct, that is a fictional film, great film.
Obviously. Yeah, great film.
But yeah, essentially it was the same practice. That's precisely what they did. They would have it dropping down the inside of their trousers, and they've just tread it into the ground. But that was other escapes. That was not this one.
Yeah, sorry, I keep getting distracted by other escapes.
Not a problem. There's nothing wrong with segues.
They're all very interesting. That's why we're doing this.
They are, exactly. And there are hundreds to look at.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be doing this in 2045. So, yeah, they disperse it in the theatre.
Right.
As it kind of progressed, they realised they needed a third person to help out with the organisation of the vaulting, some of the digging, to rotate the tunnellers, because it's not a very pleasant atmosphere down there.
No, I can imagine. And you would have been down there for a period of time, I would have thought,
at least an hour. And, you know, if you've ever kind of even just kind of crawled underneath your duvet and just breathed for a while, it gets warm and it gets a bit stuffy and disgusting, and yeah, it was like that, but without all the luxuries of being able to get out quickly. And because it was only a human body's width wide, you could only crawl in and out the same direction. You couldn't turn around.
Oh, gosh.
So you had to crawl backwards
to
get out. So if there was a collapse or anything like that, you were... there wasn't quick reactions, if you like. You couldn't get out that quickly.
And I don't suppose if there was something that had gone wrong behind you, you couldn't turn around to fix it or help stop something like that.
Exactly. And that's actually kind of why they brought in the third person, which was... Philpott, who we'll touch upon in the next episode. And so, yeah, they brought him in, and ultimately there were three that got out.
Can I just ask, though, a quick question before move on?
Go ahead.
Because there's clearly more people involved in this escape than the three that left.
Yeah.
So that means they had willing accomplices who were helping them do this but had no intention of escaping themselves.
Precisely, yeah. And...
To me, that's strange, because you would have thought you would want to be the person who leaves, who gets out.
Yes, but I suppose this goes back to the sort of 5 to 15% thing. You know, there were... Just because you didn't want to get out yourself and risk being shot at, didn't mean you weren't willing to help others who were daft enough to make that take that risk. The prison population weren't necessarily against escape efforts. They just weren't necessarily wanting to do it themselves. And so you would get willing accomplices who were quite happy to sort of take part in aspects of an escape, whether that's security or dispersal or, I keep going back to the Great Escape, but there were only 200 spaces for escape. Only 76 got out, but there were 600 people involved in this, in the overall effort.
Yeah.
These were people who were doing all various... aspects of it,
but I mean, even in the one, even this one we're talking about, there seemed to be quite a few more people involved with helping carrying the horse out and helping organize the vaulting and doing all that stuff, who must have been aware of what was happening.
Some were, certainly the ones who were on the escape committee, and by and large, the rule was that if you were on the escape committee, you couldn't escape yourself because you were the in charge of coordinating them.
Yeah.
The idea was that you weren't allowed to steal any good ideas.
Right.
So if you were on the escape committee, you were largely not allowed to escape yourself. And if you wanted to make an escape attempt and come up with your own idea, you had to resign from the escape committee. That was largely the rule. I mean, these weren't structural, official structures that existed, but pretty much every serious camp had one. The senior British officer would be in charge of them, who also largely didn't make any escape efforts. And so, but as I say, just because, only 5% or so were involved in direct escape, 15% were largely involved in the overall escapes. But you still had 85% of the population who were always willing to help out here and there, maybe lend some food or just a little bit of effort here. And then vaulting, some of them, it may be that they were a great gymnast at school and just wanted to stay fit and thought, that's a great idea. And if it helps someone get out, so be it.
Such a foreign concept to me, because I feel like if I were in that situation, I would be one of the people who want to leave, out. But then again, I guess I never know, because I've never been in that situation, and hopefully I never am.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and nor have I. And that was always the question I asked myself as a kid, when I was reading these books. I was like, I always feel like I'd be one that would want to get out. But then if you find yourself in the situation where, I don't know, maybe you've got family at home and you're just kind of thinking, sit it out.
Yeah,
it'll be fine. go back to a nice career, comfortable home.
Yeah,
wife and two children.
I guess it's because in those stories, especially the ones that have been sort of fictionalized, the people who escape are the heroes, and you always want to see yourself as the hero. But I think, thinking about it as an adult now, if it were happen now, I would probably just be like, look, it's not great here, but I can survive and get out the other side.
Exactly. And I suppose that this is where prisoner war camps were different from normal prisons as well. Mm-hmm. As we now know them, although in a prison you've got a jail term, whether that's 5 years, 10 years, whatever, and you don't have that as a prisoner war. You don't know how long the war is going to last.
That's
but ultimately the war is going to come to an end and you will be free at the end of that. It's not a permanent...
Yeah.
situation. So you just want to kind of sit it out and get to the end, and as I say, the majority did. That was precisely what the majority wanted to do,
unless you're the tenacious little buggers that these are.
Exactly. And I think in a way that we aren't these days, they were brought up more and more on adventure stories in a way that we aren't so much nowadays. Obviously, the classics like Treasure Island and Kidnap, which I have mentioned before.
Yeah.
Great stories. I suppose, you know, Robinson Crusoe, that sort of thing. They are great stories, but they're not... I don't think they're as familiar with millennials as they perhaps were in the 1920s and 30s.
When, no, that's true.
When these guys were growing up.
And yeah.
Without trying to sort of be post-imperial, the imperial story was still a relevant thing in these days. It wasn't in a way that it's not now. You know, we don't have the empire anymore.
Yeah.
So people going off to, you know, the likes of Livingston going off to find Victoria Falls as they now are, were exciting stories. And, you know, people were brought up on these in a way that we're not so much now. We're almost discouraged from hero worshipping heroes of the empire,
yeah,
in a way that they weren't then. You know, they were encouraged to follow these people, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, that sort of thing, was a very current figure. And stories of escape from the First World War were very current as well. It was only 21 years between the war, and there were escapes in the First World War as well. And so, you know, the Adventure Club, I think it was called, the Escaping Club, by Johnny Evans, I think his name was, was a bestseller between the wars. And it was his story of escaping from a camp in the First World War. And so The Road to Endor is another one from the First World War. And, you know, these were current stories. And a number of them do make reference to having read these stories as young boys and then had their chance to replicate them in their own adulthood.
Yeah.
And I think nowadays we don't have that so much. Just because I read them as a child,
yeah,
that's as much to do with because of the fact that my dad grew up during the war. And so was familiar with these stories from his own teenage years and saw that I was interested and so encouraged me to read them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that was standard practice amongst our generation.
No, I have to say it wasn't for me and for other people I know, you know.
Or anyone I know for that matter.
I think it's safe to say you are the person who I know who has been the most involved, like story-wise, with these sort of stories.
Probably safe to say, yeah, of our circle, certainly. And so, yeah, that's, I suppose, where you find that 5 to 15% of escapers are from that subsection.
Okay. Speaking of... How did they prepare for the actual escape then?
So yeah, there are two parts to an escape. You have to get out the camp, but then once you're out the camp, you've still got to get out of occupied Europe.
Yeah, because it doesn't just finish once you get out the ground at the other side.
Yeah, exactly. And in actual fact, I think the second part was the harder part. You know, the real work starts once you've got out the camp.
Yeah.
When in camp, you've got as much time as you like to prepare and dig and
I guess, yeah,
build a vaulting horse out of Red Cross parcels, and you got loads of time.
And I guess if you're in the camp and you sort of say to yourself amongst your groups, right, we'll try it today, something happens and you go, right, we can't do it today, we'll be back tomorrow. Once you've got through and once you've made that decision, you can't delay anything by a day, you can't.
No,
relax.
You just
have to crack straight on with it.
Exactly, and you need to get as far away as possible as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And often that dictated how people travelled once outside the camp.
Okay,
but all the preparations, of course, took place within the camp, and so you prepare your clothes because you had to assimilate. You couldn't exactly wander around in an RAF uniform during. In occupied Germany, well, not that Germany was occupied, but occupied Europe in the middle of the Second World War, if you were in an RAF uniform, you were probably going to be picked up pretty quickly. It's, you know, safe to say. Mm-hmm. Equally, if you're in a British Army uniform, they might notice it.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, so you had to find a way to convert either your uniform or some other form of clothing into civilian-style clothing. You also had to take food because, of course, you weren't given ration coupons. Quite often you had to take money with you, especially if you were traveling by train or staying in hotels, which some did, and they did in this escape. So you needed money for that.
How did you get hold? How did one get hold of money in that situation?
So that was smuggled in.
Right, okay.
Not via Red Cross parcels, and this is very important for understanding how escapes worked, was that actually... Red Cross parcels were avoided like the plague for smuggling purposes because they were so dependent upon the food in the Red Cross parcels to feed the prisoners. They couldn't risk the Germans basically saying these are being used for smuggling.
Yeah.
Therefore, we will cut this supply off. And of course, if you're trying to encourage people to escape, it is in your best interest for them to have that additional food. So they always avoided that. So they were smuggled in via, parents might send it in, or false charities were established to smuggle these things in.
And, wow.
They were always sent to the escape committee and collected by the escape committee for distribution amongst those who were attempting escape. Pat Reed, who was the escape officer at Colditz, he eventually did escape himself. He came up with his own escape method and resigned and what have you and escaped himself. He estimated that you needed around about 60 Reichmarks to get out and travel away and for various purposes. In this one, they actually carried about 100 each. One had 150 and the other had 50, but of course they were traveling together, so they had about 200 Reichmarks for this journey. But they estimated that around about 60 Reichmarks would be sufficient to make an escape. And so, yes, they were distributed that. They would get it from the escape committee, and that would then pay for various things such as train tickets, hotel bookings, food if they were off the ration. And there were some non-coupon meals. I think I'm right in saying that every cafe and restaurant had to provide at least one non-coupon meal. It would just be things like a potato soup or something like that.
Okay.
It wouldn't be particularly spectacular. Certainly wouldn't have anything like meat in it.
But something you could sustain yourself with.
Something that you could feed yourself with. So that, you got to remember the food that was coming through in the Red Cross parcels was scarce. Coffee, chocolate. These were not readily available in occupied Europe, and so if you pulled out a bar of chocolate, you had a very high chance of being caught
because chocolate
hadn't been seen since 1939.
Yeah.
So you had to be quite careful with how you used the food that was available in the camps, and often the food that was available in the camps was better than what was available in civilian life occupied Europe. It's how they managed to bribe a lot of guards by saying, here's a jar of coffee, I need money, or photographic material for creating false papers and that sort of thing, stuff.
Because it's interesting, you're saying about interesting about how they use the food and stuff, because part of what I read in the reports was that when they were, and I'm sure you'll touch on this in a minute, because in case you hadn't figured out by now in this conversation with this information, I am the idiot. Dave knows much more than I do. But I read that they would go and hide in the lavatory to eat their food and stuff like that. And I guess that's part of the reason why, because people didn't, if you got spotted eating a ration or prison food, then that would be a giveaway for why.
So one way they got around pulling out a bar of chocolate was they made what was sometimes referred to as dog food, or variations on that theme, which was essentially boiled sugar, condensed milk, chocolate, oatmeal, that sort of thing, and made it into a really, really condensed, almost biscuit.
So the,
they would cut them up into cubes, and they'd be really rich, high in content, so you could only eat a small amount at a time, but it would almost look like a little block of fudge. Not that fudge was readily available either, but it's the sort of thing you could just pop in your mouth,
something a bit more discreet that you could just
discreet than pulling out a bar of Hershey, which might have given the game away. And so, yeah, they could just pop that in their mouth and eat their rations that way. Philpott, who escaped with them, he had worked, I think I'm right in saying that before the war, he had worked in margarine production. And so because of his knowledge of the industry, he actually used that as part of his cover. He claimed to be a Norwegian working in the margarine industry in Norway and was on a research trip or something like that. I'm sure we'll cover it in greater depth later, but he used his knowledge of that, and he had actually been collecting margarine samples so that he had them as cover,
right,
but also to eat, if he just needed something, not that
with
it's
calories, you know.
Exactly, not that it's the most nutritionally valuable of food sources, but it was there as an option, so that he could eat them if he wanted to.
Right. I apologise. I keep getting us distracted.
Yes, I think this is going to be the longest episode ever.
So the guy, they've basically, what, where do we get to? They've got to the point where they've broken.
So yeah, that we've got to, the tunnel is built and they're about to break out, and we've covered their preparation of clothes, documents, that sort of thing. You know, there were a lot of papers that you needed to travel quite often, you know, letters from fake companies saying that this is an employee who we've sent to Germany and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You needed what was called an Ausweis, which was work paperwork. The Ausweis was general ID. The Arbeitskarte was work, to prove that you were an employee, that you had a job, all this sort of stuff. But they would carry various other pieces of documents. In actual fact, Codner and Williams carried about 8 or 9 pieces of paperwork each, which was very extensive, actually. More than the average was carried, but was more than sufficient for the purposes that they needed them for. And this, of course, comes back to having loads of time to prepare this stuff. Mm-hmm. You could use the time in camp to prepare what you needed for what was a relatively short break. Once yeah. you're out and away, you're trying to get away as quickly as possible. You don't want to be hanging around for months on end. You want to try and get away. And some did. Some could get away and hang around for months on end. But in the case of the Wooden Horse, they were all away by within a very short space of time. So they broke out of the tunnel on the 29th of October 1943. They purposely broke out at 6 o'clock in the evening. So this was after the final parade of the day. So they were counted in on the 29th of October. However, there was a train at 7 o'clock from the nearby train station at Sagan, which was the train that would take them to Frankfurt. The point of that was, by being able to take a fast train to Frankfurt or towards Frankfurt at 7 o'clock in the evening, the next parade wouldn't have been until the following morning. So by the time that they realised someone had escaped and counted and worked out who it was, because they had to go through every single prisoner, right, cross-reference them with the paperwork that they had in the camp to work out who the prisoners that were escaped. So they'd know fairly quickly that 2 or 3 had got out.
But they wouldn't know who it was.
Didn't know who it was. So
okay.
You always had a couple of hours bought.
Yeah.
But by getting away at 6 o'clock and then getting the 7 o'clock train, they bought themselves a significant amount of time, because it would probably not be until the following appel, as it was known, 8 o'clock the next morning, something like that, which by the time they'd gone through all the paperwork, you're probably talking about midday the following day.
Well, so you get like a day and a half almost.
An evening and half a day, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. In which to get as far away as possible. Now, if you were travelling by foot, you could cover some decent distance in that time, but you wouldn't necessarily have got that far. But if you were travelling by train, you could be some distance away. And in actual fact, I think I'm right in saying that they were, in the case of Codner and Williams, they were actually in Stettin by the following day.
So they did well then.
They did very well. They got away, travelled by train, and were in Stettin by the time, which is a coastal port, by the time that the camp probably knew who it was. Now, I know from some of my other research that the initial manhunt, if you like, to recapture people would start at a sort of 10 mile radius of the camp, and then it would reach out to 30, 50, 100 miles, but that would take a couple of days at a time. So
wow.
They were well out of the radius of the camp by the following afternoon. By noon the following day, they were well away. So there was a nearby train station,
yeah,
which of course they took and traveled all the way to Stettin. What's interesting from this one for me is that although they didn't take a direct train to Stettin, they would take a series of local trains.
Right.
So they got out of the initial manhunt radius fairly quickly, but after that, instead of taking a train from, I don't know, Sagan to Stettin, they would go to Frankfurt and then to Kustrin and then Stettin itself. So by taking a series of local trains, you were in essence taking the train directly to a point of high military interest, as a dockyard would be, raised suspicions, and therefore there was a greater likelihood of paper checks. So by taking a series of small local trains, no one's really interested if you were heading to Kustrin.
Right.
It's not an uninteresting place, but it wasn't
but it doesn't have the same value.
It doesn't have the same military value, so yeah. There weren't the paper checks. There might periodically be one, but it wasn't as high risk. And so you were able to avoid these paper checks. Although there were some in this escape, it wasn't... There was less suspicion of them because they were travelling as a local commuter would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not dissimilar almost from travelling from Clapham Junction to Waterloo. It's a standard journey.
Yeah.
Waterloo may have been your final destination, but you might have taken a circuitous route to get there.
Yeah.
Which increased the likelihood of success.
Right, okay.
By avoiding being checked.
It's almost like they thought about this before they went.
It's almost like they did, yeah. Exactly. They got to Stettin within 2 days through this method of travel. But ultimately spent nearly 2 weeks trying to find a ship to take them all across the Baltic Sea to neutral Sweden.
Wow, so travel that fast to then just be stopped at the end.
Exactly, yeah. There were actually 5 neutral countries in Europe during the war. That's it. So your destinations were a little bit limited.
Mm-hmm.
One was Sweden. Ireland, Republic of Ireland was one. Portugal and Spain. And then, of course, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the 5 neutral countries you could travel to.
Yeah.
Everywhere else was either occupied or belligerent. You could either... there were essentially 2 routes. You could, if you wanted to, try and get to the Soviet Union. That brought with it its own issues.
Yeah.
And some did do that, but not in this case. So in this case, they headed towards the Baltic ports and to try and get a neutral ship over to neutral Sweden. So they were trying this for over a week and staying in hotels, and which of course was eating up their money, but the whole point was to try and look respectable so that because if you looked like a tramp, you were more likely to be picked up.
Right, okay.
By the local police. They weren't necessarily looking for you as an escaped prisoner of war, but you were more likely to be picked up by the local police if you looked like...
Because you looked out of place or scruffy.
Exactly, yeah. So the idea was to try and keep themselves looking presentable. Stay in a hotel, have a shower, have a wash,
yep.
Eat food without kind of looking scruffy. You could even, you know, press the clothes rather than sleeping in them.
Yeah.
Or at least take them off rather than sleeping in them so that they didn't look slept in. And but of course that eats up your money. You could only stay in a hotel for 2 days at a time before your papers might be checked by the police or taken away, in which case you were then traveling without papers. Oh, so you had to keep changing the hotels, and there's only so many hotels available, especially in a dock city which would be prime bombing target.
Yeah.
So there's a good chance that a number of hotels were bombed out, thus limiting your opportunities further. So sometimes they had to sleep rough. But by and large, they did manage to find a hotel and just kept on moving around. And the other advantage of kind of the way they travel was that they could take a shaving kit with them.
Yeah.
Which then meant, as I say, they could keep presentable.
I was actually about to say, because you were saying about looking presentable and things like that, one thing that intrigued me when I was reading through the report was there was a concern when they hadn't found a place to stay for a couple of days, not because they hadn't slept well or anything like that, but largely because they hadn't had a chance to shave in a couple of days.
Yes, yeah.
And that was, I found that interesting because, you know, if they hadn't shaved then, that was a genuine concern of getting caught. And that I found that quite particularly interesting, just that was a real concern, enough that it was in the report that they were worried about not being able to shave.
Yeah, I mean, what's a small detail for us? You know, we might be required to look clean-shaven at work.
Yeah.
Is... not quite life or death, but you know, you might get recaptured if you haven't shaved in a couple of days.
That's madness to me right now.
Exactly.
Without the context, that's crazy.
And so, yeah, there was a need to keep clean shave. If you were going to travel in that manner, you had to look like you were traveling in that manner. You couldn't really afford to let anything slip. And you know, there were paper checks, and you know, it was high risk to travel by train, but it also gave you a faster mode of transport than walking, and so you had a better chance of getting away. So it was risk and reward, really.
Mm-hmm.
What I find interesting about this escape is how often they used a cinema.
Yes, yeah, that's very true.
So they would go and sit in the cinema and just, I think it's this one where they say they ended up watching the same film about three or four times.
Yeah, I think they said four times, yeah.
And they weren't in English either, you know, they didn't have a clue what was being said.
No, I did like that. The line, I think, was something like, we watched the same film four times and didn't have a clue what was happening in it, or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see if I can find it.
And you know, because I guess that's because a cinema is a good way to hide out for a few hours at a time. You know, you go into the darkened room, watch the movie, and you know, the couple of hours have passed while you watch it, so it's a good place to hide and not be searched.
Exactly, yeah. And it was dark, so no one was necessarily looking for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great way of just kind of hiding out. And yeah. It's not the only escape that actually this takes place in. There are others that mention this. This method of, again, avoiding, you know, hiding in plain sight. You're doing what normal people do. Normal people go to the cinema.
Yeah.
So you're doing the normal thing. But again, this costs money. This is where the, you know, if you're going to look like you travel in this manner and act like a normal person and act like a local commuter or businessman, this sort of thing, you have to be able to spend money like they do.
Yeah.
So that's
course.
Where the money source is quite important. So yes, having arrived in Stettin and trying to find a Swedish ship to take them over to Sweden, their efforts to try and make contact were always quite interesting, because in some cases they would try and stow away themselves, and in other cases they would try and make contact with a Swedish sailor who was away on land,
Who was sympathetic to their sort of cause.
Exactly. I mean, they were technically neutral, but they weren't necessarily unwilling to be helpful.
Yeah.
And so there was various efforts to try and get hold of Swedish or actually Danish sailors, because although although Denmark was occupied, Danish sailors would regularly sail across to Sweden as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they eventually realized that just making contact directly with a sailor was probably the best way of doing it. And of course there were workmen from other parts of occupied Europe, especially French, were often shipped off to other parts of occupied Europe to work essentially as slave labor, really. But because there was a high number of Frenchmen who were of military age but realistically unwilling to serve, or the Germans weren't particularly wanting them to serve due to the high likelihood of desertion, or let's put it this way, the French weren't willing to serve them and the Germans didn't really want them to desert, so they didn't tend to put them into the army as such.
Right, okay.
They put them into what it was in effect slave labour, whether that was emptying docks, that sort of thing, or mining, anything really along those lines. And so one episode was they managed to make contact with some Frenchmen who took them to a cafe, and it's almost worth reading this out, because
have you got it?
I've got it.
Go and read it out. I think I know which part you're going to mention. It's quite good.
He took us to another cafe where he sat us down at a table and told the waitress in a loud voice that we were Swedes, and that if any more Swedes came in, they were to show us to our table. He then walked out and a German woman came across to us and started to talk in Swedish. Of course, Williams and Codner didn't speak a word of Swedish.
No.
Williams immediately mumbled something and walked out while Codner tried to explain that Williams was Swedish and he was French. And then they say it was a nasty moment. But, I mean, essentially you've got a wild Frenchman declaring them to be from a country that they don't speak a word of the language, in a country that is occupied, that is their enemy during the war, and a German woman comes over and tries to start speaking to them in the language that they don't speak.
Yeah.
This is a very high risk approach to being,
and that's all through that the Frenchman was a stranger to them. He was, and from what I read in the report, it seemed like he was trying to help, but it was almost like when you walk into the room and be like, okay, if there's anybody here from this country, come and talk to me over here. And you're like, you couldn't be any more suspicious in that statement.
I mean, they even say he was so obviously a conspirator that he was more of a liability than an asset.
Someone who's too keen, too eager.
And, you know, I said right at the start that what I like about these stories is the little details that come out. I'm sure we'll come to it in a much later episode, but There's one where a Black Watch soldier was essentially didn't get picked up at Dunkirk, so was walking through occupied France to try and get away via Spain, etc. and he spoke flawless German and French and ended up getting a lift from a German officer to the nearest town. It's just these little details. Wow. That, you know, it's a small episode. It was probably only a couple of hours of what was several weeks' worth of escape.
Yeah.
But it's these details that come out that I just find so interesting because these are true stories.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This isn't a detail that's been made up for a fictional story. Well, although that's not this escape. So,
yeah.
But there was one detail in this escape that I wanted to pick out on, which was Wednesday the 3rd of November. And this is what the report says. We had breakfast with a colonel and two captains of the German army. All three produced bread from their pockets to eat with their coffee. We produced American ration biscuits, feeling quite in order. And it's just this idea of these two prisoners of war who, you know, managed to book themselves a nice little hotel. You know,
yeah.
It probably wasn't spectacular. We're not talking about the Ritz here, but they've booked themselves a nice little hotel. They've gone down to the breakfast room for a bit of breakfast and ordered themselves a nice little coffee and ended up sitting down with a colonel and two captains of the German army. I mean,
And this is a few days into them being there, isn't it?
Yeah, right? They've been out about 5 days at this point.
So they're just sort of sitting there and just like, well, what can you do? Let's just have breakfast with the Germans.
Yeah, exactly. And it's these little details where, I mean, in many ways, it's very high risk.
Yeah, yeah, incredibly.
And yet they get away with it, and which is all the more remarkable because Williams didn't speak a word of German. Codner spoke it, but Williams couldn't speak a word of German.
So they managed to get away wandering around without any German
the only German he mastered, and they make quite a big deal of it in the book, and it is actually, it's mentioned in this report as well, the only German he ever actually managed to master was the phrase "Ich bin Ausländer." I think I'm right in saying that it means "I am a foreigner," and therefore couldn't speak German. So he mastered that, and that was the extent of his German. So I mean, in some ways, he could sit there with a colonel and two captains of the German army and just claim to be a foreigner. The only risk then is if he claims to be French or Norwegian, that they actually speak that language. But as I said, risk and reward. That's what you get when,
like a Swedish speaking friend from a short while ago.
exactly. So yeah, I mean, they ended up being in around the docks for nearly 2 weeks. 12 days in total.
That's a long time when you just want to get out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they would have been running out of money, out of their own food, out of hotels to stay in, because you couldn't just kind of keep circling around. And so they ended up, you know, at some stage they even ended up spending a night in one of the French work camps.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. So they ended up spending the night there, and I think it was through the Frenchman there that they actually ended up making contact with a Swedish sailor. So, of course, the ships would be coming in and out, so it wasn't always the same sailor, so you had to try and catch them when they were in, you know, on land, out of the docks.
Yeah. Because wasn't there a point at this one where they had done some like research and walked around the docks themselves, seen a Swedish ship, and then gone back the next day in an attempt to get on, and by that point
it had gone
and there was a German ship in its place.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're just like, oh, let's not carry on any further. Let's double back.
Exactly. And, you know, that must also be, you know, just heartbreaking. You know, you've identified the ship you want to get on. You go back the next day thinking, right, brilliant. Going to find a way, find a sailor, or even just stow away yourself and just find a nice little hiding place. And then, it's gone. So they eventually managed to make contact with, actually it says here, a Danish sailor. Who was happy to take them on his ship, which is great. And there are pluses and minuses to that.
Mm-hmm.
The positives are, of course, they were getting away. They were on a ship.
Yeah.
The minuses to that, although the Danish ship was going to Sweden, it was going via Copenhagen, which was in occupied Denmark, and then on to Oslo, which was in occupied Norway. So there was quite a lot of, you were sort of, it's very much out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Yeah.
And then,
I mean, because would there be searches of the ship and things like that?
At every single occupied dock, yeah, exactly.
Oh, so you've got to find a way to stow away and hide for every one of the searches.
Exactly. And, you know, you weren't, just because they were neutral, it didn't necessarily guarantee that they were willing to take them.
Yeah. Because I don't know this, but I imagine if you're like a sailor or someone who works on those boats, you would get approached fairly often by people trying to escape through.
I'd imagine so, but also if you were in the same way now that, you know, if we break the law in a foreign country just because we're not nationals, we've still broken the law and subject to their laws.
Yeah.
And the laws under the Gestapo were pretty brutal. So if the Gestapo caught you smuggling a British prisoner of war,
hey, you wouldn't want that.
The prisoner of war actually was safe. He was extremely unlikely to be shot, despite a very famous episode. You know, post Great Escape, when 50 of them were shot. That was the exception rather than the rule, and which is one of the reasons why it is so famous, because it was essentially mass murder. But by and large, so long as you could show your prisoner of war disc, which proved that you were a prisoner of war, you were safe. You were taken back to your camp, spend a bit of time in solitary confinement, and then free to make another attempt. The sailor, on the other hand, would be lined up against the wall pretty summarily and shot. So it was high risk.
Wow, that's incredibly
high.
Which is
why, although they were neutral, they weren't necessarily willing to take them.
Yeah.
And so you either had to find a hiding space yourself, or you had to find someone who was willing to take you.
Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, in this case, when they got to Copenhagen, they were actually taken off the ship and hidden in a flat, I think by the Danish underground.
Right.
Which is not uncommon for the sailors to have links to them, because obviously the underground wanted them.
Yeah,
wanted their services too, and so they hid out in the flat for a day or two in Copenhagen, and then they were taken back to a ship and as I say, sailed to Oslo, and then from Oslo they were taken to Strandstad first of all, and then from there to Stockholm, which of course was where the British consul was in neutral Sweden.
Right.
Where they actually made contact again with Philpott.
Oh, really? So they met back up with him?
Exactly, yeah. He had successfully got back and made his way to Stockholm as well, and was actually waiting for them. I mean, don't get me wrong, as much as they hung around and looking for a ship for 12 days, 2 weeks was a pretty rapid escape.
The fact that they got to the dock in 2 days and then had to be delayed, that sounds incredibly impressive.
Yeah, exactly. But Philpott actually got away even quicker, and was I think he was in Sweden within under a week, maybe. And let me just quickly check that.
So fast.
I do have it in front of me, if you just give me a second. 5 days.
5 days.
Five
wow.
days from escape to Sweden neutrality.
That's so fast.
Yeah, it's very impressive. So he was actually waiting a full what, 9 days for them in Stockholm. So And from Stockholm, they actually ended up staying in Stockholm for about a month.
Right, okay.
Until they could organise a flight back from Stockholm. They'd fly from Stockholm all the way back to, quite often, Scotland. I think I'm right in saying that they flew into RAF Lookers, which is in Fife, near St Andrews.
Right, okay. And then they'd come down from Scotland.
Exactly, because it's the nearest landing spot.
Yeah.
If you go over Scandinavia.
I guess, yeah, straight, yeah.
Although Norway was occupied, it was a risky flight, as these things always were. There were ways of, you know, you could fly back, and yeah, so they quite often land in Scotland, and in this case they landed in RAF Lookers, and not long after Christmas. So I imagine they got 29th of December 1943, so I imagine they kind of rushed off to spend Christmas with their family, or at least have some sort of celebration with their family.
I would hope so.
Yeah and so, yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to start on the wooden horse, a number of reasons. First of all, it's a very innovative escape. You know, to manage to dig a tunnel from the middle of the compound.
When people are watching you every day.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
It's, you know, it's, in many ways it's ingenious.
Yeah,
know, it's,
yeah.
It's one of the cleverest escapes, I think, from the entire war. That's not to say there weren't other examples of escaping genius that took place, but I just think it's one of the most intelligent, innovative escapes that took place, as I say, by digging the tunnel right in plain sight in the middle of the compound and getting out, and then getting away so quickly. It's got so much going for it. I just find it so interesting. But also, it was one of the first escapes that was to be published, after the war.
So okay.
The first version of the book was published in 1945. It was then rewritten in 1949 and published in 1949 under the title of The Wooden Horse. The first version was known as Goon in the Block, a goon being a derogatory term for a German guard amongst the prisoners of war. So Goon in the Block was the first version of it in 1945, and then that was rewritten.
That's so quickly after it finished.
Very quickly afterwards. And so it kind of established quite an early precedent in the post-war narrative of escapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a good place to start in that sense. Because of that, it was also one of the first films that was produced. And, you know, I mentioned The Great Escape, but there were a number of escape films that were made, such as The Colditz Story, The Great Escape, of course, and The Wooden Horse. I mean, The Great Escape is one of the later ones. It was released in 1963, which is still only 18 years after the end of the war. I mean, it's not long, but so when, you know, in that context, the film The Wooden Horse was released in 1950, so only 5 years after the war, only 1 year after the book was published. And in actual fact, there were prisoners of war who were extras in the film.
Really?
That's quite interesting. From the original camp, that some people who were doing the vaulting in the film were prisoners
of war. Were the vaulters from the prison of war? Oh, wow, that's incredible,
I believe so. Maybe that's an urban myth, but it's on the IMDb trivia.
I choose to believe that that's true.
It must be. If it's on IMDb, it must be true.
Because everything on the internet is true.
Yeah, exactly. It's flawless. And so it set an early precedent in terms of published escape stories. But then, of course, it had the impact of being one of the early films as well.
Yeah.
And it was also one of the first books that I read in terms of the escape stories. I mentioned earlier about how I read these when I was a young lad, and it was one of the very first books that I read. And so I've been familiar with this story from about the age of 8 or 9. And so it seemed very appropriate to have The Wooden Horse Escape as the first episode of the podcast for you, The War Is Over.
I have to also say, just a sort of small personal story that I will interject slightly here.
I know where this is going.
having known Dave for a while, just a short while ago, earlier this year, we did an escape room for his birthday.
We did.
Which was World War II themed, prisoner of war, had to escape from the POW camp. And in the corner of the room when you first walked in, there was a wooden horse.
There
just
was
sat
a wooden
in the
vaulting
corner.
Horse. Yep.
A wooden vaulting horse that, for the rest of us, we all kind of went, oh, that's a nice aesthetic, yeah, everything that's there, looking around the room. He immediately got excited about this about this horse in the corner of the room and immediately knew that at some point we would be crawling through a tunnel that led from underneath that horse because of this story.
Yep.
And I've never seen a man more excited to, when we got to that puzzle and we're trying to figure it out, to volunteer to be the man that went underneath to figure out the puzzle to get out so he could be the first man to crawl through the tunnel.
Yeah, but I mean, even greater detail of that was the music.
Oh, yes.
That came on, because as soon as you worked out the tunnel through this wooden vaulting horse, they started playing the theme tune to The Great Escape.
They did, yeah, just very quietly in the background. It just appeared as he crawled underneath and he figured it out. You just heard that music kick in.
Oh, it was a glorious detail.
But it was good fun. But that's how, that I could tell, that's how ingrained this story and from there, probably many of the others, are ingrained in you and your personality, just from that moment of excitement of seeing that horse in the corner and knowing before the rest of us in the room, you knew before us.
Yeah.
That was going to be happening.
But I didn't want to ruin the fun of working out how we got there.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't want to go straight to it, because, you know, it's part of the fun is working out how you reach the point where you get to climb through the vaulting horse.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. You didn't mention it until we had got to that point, and you were just like, yeah, I knew that was happening.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the story of Williams and Codner's escape via the wooden horse.
Okay, well, thank you everybody for listening to this week's episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, please consider subscribing to the podcast. We could be found on Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, or any of your favourite podcast platforms.
Or you can follow us on Twitter on @FYTWIO.
If you'd like to send us a more long-form message, then you can also email us at fytwiopod@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.